It is Friday, August the 11th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, could Guam be in North Korea's crosshairs?
For the people of Guam, every threat is taken seriously. This is like the third or fourth since 2013.
Africa migrant drownings off Yemen, diagnosing and treating malaria.
We need to do better at getting the evidence and teaching the providers and ourselves what to do when a malaria test is negative.
We'll also have social media and a new film from Hollywood. It's all ahead. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis has warned war with North Korea would be catastrophic and said diplomatic efforts were yielding results. Speaking to reporters, Mattis was asked how he would gauge North Korea's threat to the region and the world.
I think the best way to show how it is widely gauged is look at last weekend when the UN Security Council voted unanimously to characterize this as a threat, a North Korean threat to the world's community. How often do you see France and China, Russia, the United States, I can go on. How often do you see them voting unanimously on any issue? And you saw that last weekend.
Mattis's comments came shortly after President Trump warned North Korea it should be nervous if it thinks of attacking the U.S., and doubled down on a vow to, in his words, rein in fire and fury on Pyongyang if it continues to threaten the U.S. Like Mattis, Mr. Trump also mentioned the U.N. Security Council voting imposing more sanctions on North Korea because of its missile and nuclear program.
The people of this country should be very comfortable. And I will tell you this, if North Korea does anything in terms of even thinking about attack of anybody that we love or we represent or our allies or us, they can be very, very nervous. I'll tell you what, and they should be very nervous because things will happen to them like they never thought possible, okay? He's been pushing the world around for a long time. And I have great respect for what China and what Russia did and those 15, we got a 15-0 vote. I have great respect for China and Russia, what they did on sanctions. I believe that will have an effect. I don't think it will have the kind of effect, even though we were the ones that got it. And Nikki Haley did a great job. We all did a great job. But I have great respect for what they did. I have great respect for the 15-0. But probably it will not be as effective as a lot of people think it can be.
After that Security Council voting, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un struck a defiant tone, even mentioning he might order an attack on the U.S. territory of Guam and Micronesia in the Western Pacific. Before World War II, Guam and four other territories, American Samoa, Hawaii, Wake Island, and the Philippines, were the only American jurisdictions in the Pacific Ocean. Today, Guam continues to be a strategic military base for the United States. My colleague Philip Alexio spoke to the governor of Guam, Eddie Baza Calvo, for his reaction to threats from North Korea to attack his island.
I think for my administration, I think for the people of Guam, every threat is taken seriously. This is like the third or fourth since 2013. And so with that, there is worry, there is concern, but there is not panic. Things have changed since 2013 as we are looking at reports in the media. But then at the same time, also the government of Guam, our civil administration, together with our local Joint Region Marianas, the military command, and also in discussions with Washington, with the White House and NSA, we feel very confident in the ability to protect the island of Guam. So with that, it's important to give reassurance to the people of Guam that they must, conduct business every day as if it's on any other normal day. We get 10 to 15,000 tourists a day in from places such as Japan, places such as Korea, Taiwan, and China. We encourage the tourists to come on in as well. But at the same time, we're hopeful the decisions are moving forward, that cool heads will prevail, and We will not see any increase in terms of tension and ultimately hostility. So this island and its people have gone through war. We believe it is a horror. But then at the same time, it's important, and I think that's been very important for our administration since 2013, to separate what the rhetoric that is occurring, and a lot of it through the media, and through folks that are in positions of power, but get to the details of really what are the facts on the ground. What is the situation in regards to increasing of military movements in North Korea, as well as what is occurring on the ground in Guam? And I can tell you, after being briefed many times since 2013, as we have as a civil government worked more closely in coordination with the United States military, is that there is, I would say, a very strong, formal, organized system in place for any type of ramp up in terms of some sort of action, and as well as the defensive umbrella that is a part of the United States and its allies system in this part of the world. And I talk about defense assets in Korea and Japan, defense assets in the Western Pacific, and the defense assets that we have also in Guam. I feel very confident that our people are protected. And at the same time, we're hopeful that things will de-escalate. And we're also hoping that our leadership in Washington can work with our allies in Japan and South Korea and bring in those vested interests, such as China. It's to China's best interest that this thing calms down, because, the direction that the North Korean leader is moving towards, there obviously is not the right direction. And aside from the United States, I think Japan and South Korea will also, if he continues this way, move in a direction that they believe is important for their safety and security as well.
And Governor, what are your thoughts about the way the president has responded to North Korea?
As an American governor in Ground Zero and a Chamorro Guamanian that has lived his life here in Guam, if Guam or Honolulu or Los Angeles is threatened with an attack, it is my hope that a U.S. president will be very clear in his message to potential adversaries that it will be met with overwhelming force. And whether it's hell or fury or brimstone. So that is not my concern.
Guam Governor Eddie Baza Calvo speaking with my colleague, Philip Alexio. Well, as you might expect, what's going on between the U.S. and North Korea is surfacing a great deal on social media. For some insight, VOA's Doug Bernard joins us.
Well, Steve, it's probably not going to be any surprise that North Korea is still dominating a lot of talk and chatter out there on social media. Now, it's manifesting in a number of different ways. I know often we share comments, what people are saying, but I think it's also interesting, just take a quick moment to look at how what people are saying and sharing is evolving over time. So when this story first broke just a day or so ago with the Washington Report post that North Korea had successfully miniaturized nuclear weapons to be able to put on their weapons. And then, of course, a few hours later, we heard from President Donald Trump using some perhaps spicy or forceful rhetoric himself. There was a lot of opinion. People were confused. They were sharing opinions. They liked what they heard. They didn't like what they heard. And it didn't even break down necessarily into pro-Trump or anti-Trump. It really was, all over the map, criticizing the United States, criticizing North Korea, criticizing the international community, China, et cetera, et cetera. What I've been seeing today, actually, and a lot of this is coalescing with the hashtag NOKOR, just NOKOR, which is short for North Korea. People seem to be moving away a little bit from the sharing of opinion these days or today. and doing more kind of sharing of information that they're seeing, whether it's a news article or a background kind of story or feature on Guam or on, you know, the evolution of nuclear weapons in North Korea, that kind of thing. So I think we're going to just keep watching this as the days go by and monitor, you know, what people are not just saying and sharing of their own opinions, but what kind of information they're sharing as well.
Many thanks, Doug. That is VOA's Doug Bernard. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. The International Organization for Migration says it's searching for human smugglers who it says forced 120 Somalis and Ethiopians into the sea as their vessel approached the coast of Yemen, causing more than 50 teenagers to drown, teenage migrants. Lisa Schlein is reporting now from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
Survivors tell migration officials the smugglers panicked and forced the migrants into the choppy sea when they saw Yemeni authorities as they approached land. International Organization for Migration spokeswoman Olivia Hayden tells VOA the migrants knew they could die but were helpless to resist.
There was one lead smuggler who was directly instructing the migrants, but he did have other smugglers working on the boat with him who were armed with guns and other weapons. So the migrants had a choice. They would either be harmed more than they'd probably been already on the journey, shot, or jump into the sea. Some were actually physically pushed as well.
The IOM says 29 people died, 22 are still missing and presumed drowned. Hayden says 42 people left the beach before IOM staff could reach them. She says 27 surviving migrants, both females and males around 16 years old, are receiving urgent medical and psychological care. After the smugglers dumped their human cargo, she says they turned back to Somalia to pick up more people and bring them back on the extremely dangerous, deadly voyage.
Boats are making this journey all the time where people are being abused and raped en route so that their families will pay more. Some people are paying as little as $100 US, but then en route they're tortured, they're abused, their families are made aware of this and are forced to pay up to $1,000 or $2,000 more.
Hayden says it is unlikely the smugglers will be caught. Nevertheless, the IOM is trying to gather more information on the smugglers to pass on to the authorities. She says greater international cooperation is needed to halt or reduce the trade in human beings. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A comprehensive new study finds that RDTs, those are rapid diagnostic tests for malaria, are reducing the overuse of malaria medications. However, the study also found some surprising unintended results. Researchers at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine analyzed 500,000 patient visits across malaria-endemic regions of Africa and Afghanistan. One unexpected result found that many of these patients were being given antibiotics or malaria drugs despite testing negative for malaria. Dr. Heidi Hopkins was one of the researchers conducting the study. She speaks with VOA's Kim Lewis about the study.
This was an analysis of data from 10 different studies that were designed in a harmonized way. And those studies were conducted by an international team of collaborators across several African countries and also one Asian country, Afghanistan. In all of these studies, rapid diagnostic tests for malaria were implemented in different settings, in public health facilities, in community health worker environments, in private clinics. The overall finding was that RDTs do help us appropriately and safely reduce the use of antimalarial medicines, in particular artemisinin and combination therapies.
At the same time, you all did make some other findings, some that were maybe surprises or concerns that you found in your study.
That's right. So in addition to the positive impact in terms of appropriately reducing the overuse of antimalarials, we also found two things in particular that surprised us and that were less desirable. Number one, we found that when patients didn't get an antimalarial because their test was negative, instead the clinicians or the providers often gave an antibiotic. Sometimes that may be appropriate, but not always, and it's a challenge because that now is going to contribute to antibiotic resistance, bacterial resistance, if we begin to overuse antibiotics instead of overusing antimalarials. The second thing we found that was surprising was that a large proportion, even up to 20% in some cases, of patients who tested positive for malaria were not given an ACT or were not given an antimalaria at all.
So then where do you all go from here? What is your next step?
We'd like to understand more about why providers are making these decisions. Of course, it's not just the technology. If you just put in a rapid diagnostic test in place, that doesn't solve all the problems. The healthcare providers need to understand how the tests work. And more importantly, they need to know what to do when the malaria test is negative. In many parts of the world, no matter how much training you have, no matter how much capacity you have, it's very challenging to determine what's causing a case of fever if it's not malaria. And we need to do better at getting the evidence and teaching the providers and ourselves what to do when a malaria test is negative.
Why is it such a challenge to treat malaria?
Malaria is not that hard to treat. If you've got a blood test that's showing that a patient has malaria and you have the appropriate medicine, which in most parts of the world now is an artemisinin combination therapy or ACT, if you can get the good quality drug to the patient and the patient can take it appropriately, that malaria will be gone. It's not that hard to treat malaria.
Why is it that some people who were diagnosed with malaria, they did not receive the treatment?
We have the same question. We don't have evidence to explain that clearly because we didn't expect that result and therefore we didn't go looking for the reason. I can maybe speculate, having spent a lot of years in different African settings myself and watched how health workers work, I could suppose that even if there was not a shortage of drugs in these study sites, people who are used to working in settings where there are drug shortages, where there are stockouts, people run out of medicine, maybe they have a way of thinking that they want to conserve the medicines they do have, maybe for sicker patients, maybe for somebody who's less able to go and buy separately. So I'm just speculating. We don't have any evidence to support that, but that's one reason that comes to mind when we think about why this might have happened.
And also in looking at those people who tested negative and still were receiving some type of medicine, even antibiotics, what would you think the mindset be for that?
I think when you're working in a low-resource setting and you know that some of your patients are coming from quite a distance away, people come from several kilometers away walking or on a motorcycle, you're reluctant to send them home without something powerful. And people think of antimalarials or antibiotics or certain types of medicines as powerful. And if you don't have a clear diagnosis, still want to do something, the patient wants something, even if the health worker feels like he or she could send the patient home just with some Panadol or paracetamol and fluids, the patient may insist or the parent may insist. And so there's a number of different things that work together to give the outcome.
That's Dr. Heidi Hopkins, one of the researchers in the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine Study. She was speaking with Kim Lewis, host of the VOA program, Africa News Tonight.
Hi, this is Lori London. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondence reports around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
Many summer camps here in the United States focus on a single activity, such as baseball or computers, horseback riding maybe. But there's this camp out in California. It's serving a growing population of transgender children. We get more now from VOA's Faith Lapidus.
Rainbow Day Camp offers kids a welcome break from the academics of the school year and also from the stigma of being seen by society as different. These 4 to 12-year-olds are transgender. Here, they can use the pronoun of their choice and meet other transgender kids and adults, including many of the camp's counselors.
They're following their creative interests, and they don't have this added stress or weight of being othered. They get to be their most authentic selves and build community with other people who understand the same life experience.
The need for that community is what inspired Sandra Collins to start the camp 2 years ago.
I used to say that the camp began out of sadness because of this experience, but a friend encouraged me to reframe it, that the camp began out of love, out of trying to create a safe space for my daughter and then other kids who were like her.
There are more and more kids like her in the U.S., which does not surprise developmental psychologist Diane Ehrensaft.
We expect a 2-year-old to know, I am boy, I am girl. So why can't that also apply to transgender children, to know it just as well as children who aren't transgender?
Molly Maxwell says that's what happened when her child was a toddler.
Once she learned to talk and have a voice, it was just she was very insistent that she was not a boy, she was a girl, and to call her a girl.
A study released this year showed that allowing this social transition can have a positive benefit on young people's mental health. James Kaplan's mother doesn't regret allowing her child to transition.
I had to mourn the loss of my daughter and at the same time welcome my son and get to know him. And as soon as he transitioned, he was happier. He was confident. He was light.
The 60 kids at Rainbow Day Camp this summer are certainly happier.
I like to be who I am, and it's not fun to be who I am not.
I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's almost 20-year Cassini mission is only weeks from its expected spectacular ending when it's sent plunging through the dense atmosphere of Saturn. Now in its last stages of the spacecraft's grand finale, Cassini will make its final 5 orbits around the planet. The space agency plans to make the most of those last 5 orbits as it sends the spacecraft through Saturn's upper atmosphere. NASA says in its final orbits, Cassini will dip between 1,630 to 1,710 kilometers above the planet's cloud tops. The Cassini team says Saturn's atmosphere might be so dense that they may need to fire up the spacecraft's thrusters to maintain stability during the final orbits. After completing its last orbit on September 15th, the Cassini crew will end the mission by plunging the spacecraft into the planet. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Oscar winner Brie Larson leads the cast in a new movie that tells the story of author Jeanette Walls. VOA's David Byrd tells us that Woody Harrelson and Naomi Watts also star in The Glass Castle.
Rich city folk live in fancy apartments, but their air is so polluted they can't even see the stars. We'd have to be out of our minds to trade places with any of them.
Dr. Taylor said we should be going to real school.
A real school, huh?
This is as real as it gets, kids. You learn from living.
The Glass Castle recounts the unconventional and often poverty-stricken upbringing of author Jeanette Walls and her 4 siblings. Based on the 2005 memoir of the same name, the movie stars Brie Larson as Jeanette, the second of 4 children born to Rex and Rosemary Walls. Rex is an alcoholic and Rosemary is an artist and teacher. But neither parent can provide the stability their 4 children need. At the movie's premiere, Larson, who won the Oscar for her portrayal of a kidnapped mother in last year's Room, says that Jeanette's story shows the resilience of the human spirit.
For me, this is a story about humans and how strong and resilient they are, and that life can throw a lot at you, and that we somehow pick ourselves back up and still have this incredible capacity to love again and to care and to keep going. So to me, this is a film about a testament of survivors, that every human being is a survivor. We've all survived something, and we keep going, and it's such a wonder that we're here.
Naomi Watts plays Jeanette's mother, Rosemary. She says that the cast members truly bonded during the production and were able to tell this powerful story.
We connected with this story. We brought our own stories to the table, and it was kind of a cathartic experience, and we had all the joy, all the fun, and also the stuff that would makes you so emotional as well. Like, obviously not as extreme as Jeanette's stories, but, you know, there are stuff that you could easily relate to.
Woody Harrelson plays Jeanette's father, Rex. He says that he agrees with some of Rex's methods, even if they are unconventional.
Education is, you know, better when it's experiential, better to get out in nature and just actually experience what it is you're talking about as opposed to sitting in a classroom. Some of his views on medical system I tend to agree with.
Brie Larson says that she hopes that Jeanette Walls is pleased with her portrayal.
She's just an incredible person that continues to inspire me, and I hope will be a very big part of my life for many years to come. Her capacity to accept and move and find strength and her way with words is just so incredibly powerful to me.
The Glass Castle is directed by Destin Daniel Cretton, who also directed Larson in 2013's Short Term 12 and directed this year's The Shack. It is distributed in the U.S. by Lionsgate and is rated PG-13. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Well, it turns out that two of Pablo Picasso's silver platters are among many rare curated items for a collection. They're going to be shown in the U.S. state of New Mexico soon. Picasso once commissioned French silversmith François Hugot to cast a series of plates and medallions in gold and silver from his original ceramic models and designs. These are part of that. Many thanks for being with us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zainab Abdul-Rahman, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a super Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States congratulates the people of Rwanda on their active and peaceful participation in the presidential election held August 4th. More than 6.6 million Rwandans cast ballots for Mr. Kagame, according to the official tally, though this number appears inflated. Just over 80,000 voted for the opposition. The government claimed turnout totaled 97.6%. But the electoral process fell short of democratic standards. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert said, "We are disturbed by irregularities observed during voting and reiterate longstanding concerns over the integrity of the vote tabulation process." The United States commends the Rwandan media for reporting on complaints of harassment of some opposition candidates and Rwandan citizens during the campaign. The U.S. also commends average citizens, the National Electoral Commission, and government officials for speaking out and addressing those complaints. Spokesperson Nauert added, "We applaud the televised presidential debate," while noting that voters' understanding would have benefited from broader participation of the candidates themselves. The U.S. remains concerned by the lack of transparency in determining the eligibility of prospective candidates. It is hoped the new electoral law to be debated in the next session of Parliament will clarify that process well before the 2018 parliamentary elections. Rwandan President Kagame has led the country of 12 million people since his rebels helped to end the 1994 genocide, in which more than 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus were massacred by Hutu extremists. Under President Kagame, Rwanda has made great economic strides, but his critics say this has come at the expense of civil liberties and media freedoms. Human rights groups report that his government has used state powers to silence the opposition through systematic repression. A constitutional amendment in 2015 allows Mr. Kagame to stay in power until 2034 if he pursues it. The United States expressed disappointment with the change to the Constitution and Kagame's decision to seek a third term. The United States encourages the government of Rwanda to foster an environment where civil society and all political parties can participate in elections without intimidation and elections truly reflect the will of the people. The United States stands by the people of Rwanda in their efforts to build strong, democratic, and inclusive institutions in order to ensure long-term stability and a democratic, prosperous future for all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.